So as Tim just said, I'll discuss about knowledge studies. It's essentially as a way to discuss about standard model results and how we can use them to probe for new physics, to look at new physics. Why did I choose this picture? Is for essentially two good reasons. The first one is that it represents the monojets, or you see, you know, the one jet, and there is something missing, you know, the missing energy. And then you see that the shore is like the border between what we know, the LEM, standard models, non-physics, and what is beyond. This is the sea for which we don't see under, and we don't know how rich it is, because I'm sure it's going to be really rich. And the other reason is because this is exactly where I want to be during Christmas time, but I won't.
The missing thing is me.
You'll come. So, right. So we'll give a brief introduction, discuss about how we look for new phenomena in particle physics, well, in colliders and stuff like that. And discuss about data-driven estimate of background monojet event. And for one reason, there is two bullets that disappear. But I will essentially show you all the large experimental limits have been obtained with those techniques, just to give you an example of and bring to a conclusion. Oh, here we go. That's the reason why I put some animation in. So as an introduction, I won't extend too much on that to tell you that the standard model is, you know, extremely successful, has been able to describe a bunch of data, the G minus 2 moment of the electron at really high precision, the electroweak parameter of the standard models at really high precision as well, such, for example, the Z width. QCD sector has been tested really with also really high precision. Even things for which you don't have predictions have been measured extremely precisely and allow us to test a conclusion about the satisfactory of the standard models for the phenomena that we observe, the weak angle, and so on and so forth. And even if you have some tension, so some kind of, you know, disagreement, like you can see over here in the 4x4SME2 with B quark and with the G minus 2 within the muons, nevertheless, those small discrepancies are not big enough to say that overall the standard model is not good. Everything worked really, really well. And this, you all know that, but what I'm mentioning is to point to two things. The first one is that if you want to find new physics, you're going to have to work hard, because the standard model is already putting hard constraint on what is beyond it. So we have to develop techniques and tools to be able to dig deeper and deeper on what we can observe. And the other bit I want to bring over here, and this is going to be probably the main important aspect of that presentation, is that why not using the success of that standard models to return it against it, against itself? So why not using that precision to essentially try to go to look deeper? And this is essentially what I want to present today. Okay, of course you're wondering why. Well, you don't wonder, but you know, somebody can ask why you want to go above beyond the standard models. Well, we have many unanswered questions. Many things to check. The electroweak symmetry breaking, it's a mechanism in the standard model, but it's not explained. There is the hierarchy problems. If you follow the solution in the standard model, you have some problem that come with it. The strong CP problems, why there is terms that are left out of the standard model, but could be there in the more general theory you can write that satisfy gauge symmetry.
Can
unification.
I ask which block you showed here? Your publication for the song.
I can't remember which publication I took, but yeah, I picked it up on the web, so it is.
I think they just signed the neutron EVM.
Yeah. But which publication here? I can't remember. Dark matter, dark energy, which is which was somehow a motivation for what I'm going to present today. Structure of space time. Point of it is that there is new physics. There is idea. But we need to find phenomena. We need to find a set of event, of data to explore, to try to understand what is this new physics? What is the thing that's going to bring you beyond, bring us beyond the standard models? And that is what we're going to do today. We're going to see how we can dismiss all the idea, focus on some set of state, and try to dig into it to find you know, a deviation that we're going to exploit later on, or you will exploit later on to push the standard models further, well, be beyond it. So what I'm going to do today is I'm going to make an illustration of one powerful approach to search for new physics with one example, which is search for large external dimensions. In a few minutes, I will discuss about this. So don't ask me why I choose extra dimensions. It's going to come in a minute. But the important point is essentially that this is just a way for me to discuss how well the Atlas detector is doing, because you want to know that. You want to know if we'll be able indeed to test stuff. Importantly, how to dig out a large background, a signal out of a large background, because typically searchers try to focus on signature for which you have really small background. And then you look, you make a small prediction with big error, but you don't care, and you look for striking deviations. But we can do important searches where the background is big, and this is what I want to focus on it today. And by the way, it's going to give you an idea of how the actual large dimension limits have been obtained, for example. But this is not just limited to this extra dimension stuff. So the first part about looking for new physics is first to choose a final state, to choose a phenomenon to explore. New physics searches are experimentally possible to with minimal set of theory assumptions. Basically, you can go out there and make experimental search without assuming mostly anything about theory, about new physics. And this is really good, because in the past, you know, you guys came with the models, we were trying it and coming feeding back to you. But we can be clever enough to design our measurement in such a way that we are not relying on any theory. And then we basically satisfy not just the theory next door, but most of the people that are interested in this kind of final state. We just need to find a final state with some motivation. Different models can contribute to the same phenomena, right? And usually, those models are toy assembled models that are not really solving the actual problem we try to solve. And if we gauge ourselves on these kind of toy model, we might just, you know, fool ourselves. They are often difficult to disentangle. You will have two different models predicting really similar phenology that, experimentally speaking, it's hard to disentangle. So, you know, focusing on one might miss you something on the other one, and so on. And in case of a discovery, interpretation will only be speculative at the really beginning of that discovery, right? It's the full consistent story that we will make with many discoveries and many ideas in there that are going to build up to something new, right? So the point is that there is no good reason to favor one model over another when we do a search in a given final state. Try to be as more general as possible. Try to do signature-based search. Also, it allows us to don't miss the unexpected physics because of our selection. So the idea is always coming in the selection and the phase space that you choose and stuff like that. So if you don't do any optimization for particular models, well, then if there is some idea that was not there on the market but came later on, we will not, you know, eliminate it. And of course, if you find no significant deviation whatsoever, then you can put severe constraints on benchmark models for comparison. And for example, we can now use extra dimension, and this is in that context that I'm bringing it, as a benchmark models to set limits on it, and that we can distribute to the community, and then people, you know, can say, okay, now they use this limit to set to constrain these parameters. If I convert this to my models, then, you know, I'll be able to use information to constrain my models, right? There is other way to do it from examples. There is even people in the audience that are working more general tools for doing this. But I think the beginning is to provide a benchmark and allow theorists to use this benchmark to constrain their own work. So this is in that context that I'm bringing extra dimension today. Now, of course, there is a price to pay for model independence, right? Because you try to make your selection in such a way that you don't maximize your limits on one model. So it means that, you know, you can have a bit of fluff of sensitivity for that benchmark models. But if nobody cares about the benchmark models, we are caring about the limits of being a bit lower. That sounds trivial, but it's definitely not trivial in my day-to-day work and collaboration, you know.
But I mean, this is a serious thing, right? I mean, you can have a serious loss of sensitivity.
Because, absolutely.
Right? So it's not, even if you didn't care about the benchmark itself,
absolutely. And it's out of the topic, but it happens for me that I'm doing model independence all the time, you know. And it happens to me that, you know, one of the comments like, well, you get lower limit than this other experiment on that model that you choose. And I say, yes, but I change the beta parameter by 0.1 and I get better limits for all the other parameters, in fact, you know. So exactly. You need to be a bit, you know, sensitive that we are working in N with theorists. We need to provide as much information as possible and not just overkill things that nobody cares about. So essentially, yeah, why I'm choosing extra dimension in that scenario, it's because from the model independence perspective that I brought, this is a really good benchmark model because it's a simple model. It just have one parameter, the size of the extra dimensions, let's say, and you can see the number of extra dimensions, which is an integer parameter to add to this. But that is really simple. You can easily take limit on that, extract it as a cross-section limit, and apply it to your models.
The other advantage. The most important model here.
Which one?
The Burgess model?
It's there. There is also advantage because you know you want to have a model to choose a you know motivation for which we have many others models if you don't believe this one. So that you know if the models get killed, if the experimental models get killed for some reason, then there is nevertheless really interesting theoretical aspect of this search, for example.
The class of things you're looking for is visible, big invisible channel with access to one bit.
At this point, yeah, I'll just find the next slide. Yeah. But this is effectively what we have over here. And of course, one model might have more, generally have more than one signature as well, right? So here we focus on monojet, that was a title. Large instrumentation has other than just monojet's signature. But this is one motivation for it. And the last thing you want to have in your justification, maybe I'll push this a little bit, is at least to be able to solve some problems. So, you know, some people over here are using it to solve the cosmological constant problem. Well, that definitely worked us looking for this. So we have a strong justification to use this as a benchmark.
That's right, yeah.
I want to justify my PhD, you know. So without going into the theory details, because you all know this really, really well, the only things I want to focus is on now why this model is bringing you monojet event.
Can we just go a little slower? So why would you consider the quark anti-quark state? Is it much better to consider the blue state in LHC?
I'm considering in the actual codes, we're considering everything. It's just a picture.
Oh, this is just, okay.
In fact, if you look over here,
this is just schematics.
It's just schematics. You know, when we have a calculation, we have all the processes and cell, and you know, depending on the regime, one take advantage over the other one. Now, if I remember well, it was the quark gluon that was dominating in the LHC regime, isn't it? Whatever, it's not important. The point is that you have a coupling which is extremely, extremely small, but you have a phase space which is really big, so your production rate is big. But when you produce one graviton or whatever gravity particles, because it doesn't need to be a graviton, it could be scalar graviton or you know a bunch of other states that couple, that goes into the extra dimensions.
I'll tell you why I'm hanging on this up just a little bit.
Yeah.
Because depending on what exactly is the production mechanism, you may be more forward radiating or more central.
Yes.
So it does make a little bit of a difference.
It does. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So is it dominated by T-channel exchange?
So this is what I'm trying to remember. So definitely change with the number of extra dimensions. I have the Tibetan one in mind, and the Tibetan was QQ bar dominated, obviously,
yeah.
Right? At the LHC, if I remember well, it is QG which is dominated, which makes sense also just from PDF point of view. But there is a regime and there is an N on the extra dimension for which there is a swap, which is happening. But I can't remember by heart what it is. But the point is, so that you produce one particle, that particle is so weakly coupling to the rest of the matter that in our detectors, we can't see it. So what we see is essentially unbalance of momentum in the detector, and that we call jets. So this is why we have one jet plus missing ET. But if I was bringing it from a justification from split SUSY, for example, for which we have two invisible particles, you will have nothing from your final state, but you will have an initial state radiation and something like that that's going to give you your jet and stuff like that. And that is really interesting, because that will probe the jets to be high energetic, Well, if your jet comes from, you know, from an initial state transition from QCD, then the jet would be lower energetics. So you don't want to constrain yourself in one final state. You want to look at broader spectrum of the final state in order to not miss models, right? Yes.
In this process, you have to worry about, it's like the trail yarn process. You have to worry about Python distribution function models.
Yes.
It's very model dependent.
So. Yeah, so we have uncertainties on this.
So how do you just have to play an important role?
How do we?
Just we're playing an important role in simulating.
Absolutely. So we're taking different PDF sets and we're doing this into the simulation, and we see how much our predictions and limits change out of it, and we assign a systematics uncertainty out of it. Now, the PDF uncertainty is at the level of 5 to 8%. It's not a big, big uncertainty, but it's there. It's definitely there. Yeah.
By the way, if the dominating process is really quark gluon, then you may be able to extract some of it from data, because you can look at prompt photon, which is also quark gluon. Try to extract the PDF from that process.
Right, so try to extract the PDF from that process. I mean, we're doing many PDF measurements, so taking the W charge asymmetry is even more sensitive to PDF and stuff like that.
It does mean in the sense that for the prompt photon, you can literally just replace the photon by the...
But the point is not to understand the PDF in there. The point is to use them with their understanding to probe that part that we don't understand, right?
That's true, but, you know,
you're saying
you
quote the ratio or something, they won't
exactly
at all.
Yeah.
No, yeah, if you use ratio PDF uncertainties, will go away, yes. And the point is that there is two things in there. There is the predictions and there is the limits, right? And the whole talk, I'm just slide 11, is to show how we can deal with the predictions. And in the predictions, we bypass all these uncertainties. This is exactly what I want to show today. You need to carry them in the interpretation, but the interpretation is just a benchmark. We don't care much of it. We know from the predictions if we have no new physics in this or not. The limits on the Planck scale or whatever, it's even not interesting in the sense that we're taking models for which you have an expansion terms truncated after dimension 6 operators, and we are probing higher energy than this. So the phase space for which we have dropped the higher order terms, and in fact for which it could be higher than the Planck scale, is quite important at the LHC, right? So the all bits of the prediction of the limits itself is not that important. The prediction is important, and in predictions we control PDF, we control all the other systematics uncertainty to make it as precise as possible. And that's what I want to present today. So how to look for new phenomena. Once we have an idea, when you choose a final state, you need to have a device for this. Basically just a pretext for me to discuss, to send a few words about the LHC. Because it's amazing. It's the world largest and highest energy machine that we have, which you all know, 27 kilometer circle. It's big, you saw this also before. Now we had 70 even the center of mass energy in 2010, 2011, and potentially 2012 as well, which is just half of what we had. But it's nevertheless extremely, it's incredible, you know. We needed to have, you know, thousands of dipole magnet to bend the beam around that circle. That means that there's a lot of energy stored both in the beam, but in the magnet themselves, because they need to be cool and stuff like that, and they are extremely powerful. So the numbers in there, we're doing microphysics, we're doing, you know, the tiniest scale ever probed, and the machine is so big and so macroscopic that this is extremely, you know, interesting. And the amount of data we collect every second is just tremendous, right? And it forces us to be organized and to develop interactive tools and collaborative tools like these computer grids around the world to be able to analyze those data. And, you know, my colleagues and myself is complaining all the time about the grids because it's never worked exactly the way you want. But it's so fantastic, we shouldn't complain, really. And in fact, you know, it's so fantastic, it's not surprising that people would get excited about this. This is when we turn on the beam the second time. The second time means after the catastrophic in 2000.
This is not when it broke.
Huh?
This is not when it broke.
That's not when it broke, yeah. And when you look at the energy in the magnet, which is stored, it's not surprising also that you can make big damage if something is going wrong. So they talk about this in newspapers, e-news, at the tele, in Russia, Even in TV show, they discuss about, you know, the LHC in movie. Google has something to say about it. So it's bringing a lot of enthusiastic. And one of our mission is not just to to do physics, but also to communicate this enthusiastic to the outside world, to people, which is paying for this, really. So the LHC, it's a big machine, but Atlas as well. When you see this, this is like me. Well, somebody like me. And this is a full detector. In that bit, you have 80 million channels. So 80 million bits that is giving you signals at the rate of, you know, every 25 nanoseconds. So the first question to ask about before looking for new physics is, do you really understand your beast? Just to show you a bit how it builds, so you have the inner part which is built for tracking track for measuring momentum, basically, which is in fact a three-piece, a pixel detector, a bit like your digital camera, another one based on silicon detectors, and another one which is helping you to disentangle electron and pion, for example. Then you want to measure energy, so you have your calorimeter bits around your tracker, and this is also made with various pieces. You have liquid argon technology for active materials in both the end cap and the barrels. The barrel is here, so you can see something like, you know, well, it's a cylinder, it's a concentric cylinder, and we put plugs in the end. And then you want to measure hadronic activities. Why I'm mentioning it? Because I will show you all, we detect those particles. So just want you to see that where they happen in the detector, and you know there's an actual kit that is down there in the pit that is measuring stuff. So you see here the hadronic calorimeters in the barrel part. So again, circulating like this. And these are the wheels. And an interesting thing built in Canada is the Ford calorimeter over here, which work in really radiation hard environment, but it allows you to keep a really high hermeticity in your detector, which is important. Hermeticity is crucial if you want to do monojet event, right?
So what ETA is this sitting at?
Huh?
What ETA coverage is this?
3.2 to 5.
3.2 to 5?
Yeah.
So it's just for advanced stuff.
Well, an electron as well.
And it's sitting on both sides? Or
yes.
One?
No, both sides. Yeah. And you have the muon spectrometers. And this is really interesting because this is a toroid magnet.
What do you mean by electrons? You won't be able to tell it's an electron, right?
Huh?
You won't be able to tell that it's an electron.
Well, you can. You can.
Really?
Because you'll see in two slides. So this is a toroid magnet. And that means that in the full detector will be here. Your muon goes through it and then get curved in that region over here. Sorry to touch the screen like this. Basically, that means is that we have a device that independently measures the muon momentum from the inner detector. And that is extremely powerful to do IPT muon physics. So and then we gain in precision by having such a huge device. So now the question is, how can we use this device and show that we understand it, okay? So to answer your questions, we have all the particles that we know.
What about the CMS detector?
Huh?
The CMS is not getting any attention.
He's not from CMS, he's from
Atlas. Yeah, I'm Atlas.
Someone should be saying something about CMS.
Well, we have a CMS picker around.
And as far as I know, maybe they're hiding it. They're not doing the same thing as we are doing over here. So, but of course, if you have a CMS speaker, you will say how great this detector is, and it is. It is. So electrons leave you a track that you don't have in the forward region, but you have a deposition in the electromagnetic calorimeter. You won't be able to disentangle with a photon, right? But at least you can use, for example, stuff like if you have a forward electron and a central electron with your track in the different mass of CZ or something like that, you'll be able to see that was an electron or something like that. So there is tricks in there. It degrades the resolution, it's a bit worse, but nevertheless, you can do something. Another thing is that when we're doing jets, if you want to remove an electron background, you can ask, you can veto event on the infraction of the jets, for example, and stuff like that. You have muons that give you a track both in the and the inner detectors and the muon spectrometers. So this is basically the signature of what you're looking for on muon. And then you have jets that are essentially a collection of tracks and a disposition of energy in both calorimeters. And then the one that's interesting, another one which is interesting for us is the missing momentum. So if you have a neutrino or a graviton or whatever, it doesn't leave any energy in the detector. So you get this, this direction by the balancing of the momentum in the full detector, right? So the point of this is that standard models and new physics properties are inferred from the kinematic studies of the known particles, right? So we want to know if we're able to understand those known particles really well. So for example, if you bring precise measurement of the invert mass of electron or photon pair, you can measure your standard candlestick, the particles, the resonance that we know, measure their width compared to theory, and see what is your resolution in your detectors, and if your detector is well calibrated. And if it is not well calibrated, then you calibrate it. Also, it's not because you have an electron in your detector that you actually see it, because you apply a bunch of selection to disentangle it from background and stuff like that. But what is the probability to find one? We can measure it, and we can estimate it from our simulations. And if we have a good matching, it means that we do understand how to detect electron. And this tells us that we have this understanding. Same thing for muons. You can do the same job. The way you reconstruct a muon is different. Nevertheless, you have the same candlestick with the same width and stuff like that, and you can use them to measure resolution and recalibrate your muon momentum, which is extremely important. So from that plot, we can also see that we do understand muons really well in ATLAS. JETS is more cumbersome. The JETS resolution is much worse than what it is for an electron, because the hadronic calorimeter has worse resolution than the electromagnetic calorimeter, and they are non-compensating. Basically, it means that we don't measure the full energy of it. And what you can see over here is that there is a little disagreement between a measurement and our prediction. So the detector is doing a bit worse than what we were thinking in terms of resolution of JETS, but that's fine. To know this allows us to recalibrate our Monte Carlo and bring it to the level of the data.
So it seems energy dependent. Is that only the absolute value which is energy dependent?
Repeat me this?
The discrepancy seems to be energy dependent.
Well, yes. Yeah, so, but the other thing also is that we have two methods to measure the resolution. And if you can see between those two points over here, they're not giving you the same things. So what is the things? What is the right resolution? It's not clear as well, because a measurement is just a measurement, right? So it may prompt to, you know, a quantity, but there is also second order effect in there that we need to understand at some point. But there is no problem to see it's energy dependent, because the resolution is energy dependent, therefore the uncertainty on it might be energy dependent. It's eta dependent as well.
That's true, only but here it's a little strange, right? It seems to be going, there seems to be a parabola, right? There seems to be a minimum somewhere in the middle.
A minimum somewhere in the middle?
So if I look at the residuals.
Right here.
It seems to be going up, the time energy is going up.
Which is no surprising, right? So the resolution must wash much worse at low energy. So you will expect a bigger deviation.
Right.
And at really high energy, then you start to degrade the resolution again because you start to punch through your detector. So yeah, there is a minimum in, well, it's still high energy, but in the average regime, I would say, you know. And also there is a statistical effect. Because
you
have more statistics. You have fewer of them to probe them properly. But even resolution generally don't have a huge impact on your result, on your measurement, but calibration does. And you can see over here that the uncertainty could be up to, say, 10% on the calibration. This is when you use Monte Carlo to calibrate, to estimate this uncertainty and to calibrate the jet. But now when you have a lot of data, like we do, you can use a single particle response, you can use gamma plus jet and Z plus jets to calibrate your stuff, and you can bring your uncertainty to a lower level. You will have to live with this all the time, but at least you know, by working hard, you can, you know, shrink it more and more and more. So jets are an issue. We relatively well understand them, but they are an issue. Keep this in mind. Missing energy. If you don't understand jets, how can you understand global quantity like missing energy that depend on everything, that depend on jets, that depend on leptons, that depend on everything, you know? Well, what we can see is that we can at least understand the resolution of the missing ET, so the width of a distribution, when you should have no missing ET. So the point is that there is some event for which there is no missing ET, Z to EE, for example, or min bias event. There is no real missing ET in there. So when you measure, you can measure the missing ET in those ones and try to understand what it is. You can understand is resolution and so on and so forth. And then you can put back this into your simulation and see that you have a reasonably good agreement. Now, what is the percentage of level on this? You need to work hard on that. We developed data-driven estimate of the acceptance of missing ET in some cases and stuff like that. But the point is that it is a case-by-case studies. So if you do one analysis that uses missing ET and your friend is doing another one which is using missing ET, if the kinematic regime is different, the final state are different, the studies has to be different, and systematic studies has to be different as well. So it's not trivial as well. And finally, I haven't discussed about this, but then there is trigger. You know, we are keeping only 0.05% of the event that are being that come from the collisions at the center of the detector. So it's a huge rejection. You don't want to reject your good physics. You want to reject, you know, just things that we already know. So QCD bits, right? So how can you do this? Well, this is really challenging for monojet events more than anything else, because the jet rate, the jet cross-section is so high that you're forced to put IPT threshold on your jet. And so you're forced to put yourself in really the tail of the distribution, and you can miss the new physics and the low kinematic region. I was talking about split SUSY type of models for which you get your jets from initial state radiation that put yourself in a low jet region or lower, like hundreds of 100 GeV or something like that, and you will miss it if you use a jet trigger. So you're forced to work with a MET trigger. And we say MET is difficult. Imagine how difficult it is at the trigger level, because you have no time to do a right calculation, a good calculation. So I work a bit on that, well, quite a lot actually. And I'm really happy to see that, you know, we understand the missing ET at the trigger level really well. Meaning that, you know, it's not a perfect resolution, but we are able to reproduce it into a simulation and understand what is going on and decide from that all. First, we can get estimate of the efficiencies. You want to know how many events you didn't make it to your trigger, but also how to design a trigger strategy. Because with evolving instantaneous luminosity, you need to revise your trigger strategy every single day. And by the fact that we are able to understand the missing ET data, we can use a solution to develop this trigger strategy and keep the best as we can for physics. So that is really interesting. Now, I've been talking about individual objects or piece of detectors, but what happens when you move them all together into a measurement? So basically, are you able to do precise measurement of the standard models? That is the convincing bits that you understand what is going on. And looking at W and Z is really powerful because you have all the objects in there. For example, in the Z to mu plus jets, you have the two muon over here and the jets. And if you take W nu, then you have the electron and the missing ET. So looking at those events allow you to have physics that you're supposed to understand well, because standard model predictions are precise for this, and all the objects that you need to understand. This is an example of an event that you can see in three different cuts of the detector. This is when you cut the cylinder and unroll it. This is when you take a detector and you look like this. And this is when you take a plan of the detector. So these are three plans of the same thing. And what you can see is that this is a Z to mu mu plus three jets, because you see the three jets over here, and you see the two muon over here. I will not make a quiz to let you know what it is, because I wrote it, but here you see the electron, and here you see that there is an unbalance in the detector, and this is your missing ET. So this is how strictly the objects appear to us if we display them. But of course, we're not computers, so to compute the momentum, the energy, the angle, and stuff like that, we can't do it. So we have to do better analysis than just looking at those events. And for example, measuring the differential distribution and total cross-section for W and Z will tell, and comparing with theory, will tell us if we understand those things. It tells us if we are able to understand the response effect of the detector on those measurements. Are we able to unfold back error observation to predict to the theoretical predictions? Are we able to estimate efficiency right? Are we able to estimate background right? So this is what we want to show in that measurement. So the inclusive W and Z cross-section was made in 2010, and it allowed us to test The lepton reconstruction efficiency, identification, and resolution, because it goes on the cross-section factor over here, and the background. And what we add from those results is a precision of 1.2% if I neglect the 3.4% from the luminosity. This is really, really good precision for hadronic collider. We are able to show that we understand the leptons at the 1.2% level. And this allows us to already say stuff about standard models, not just new physics, but we are able to reduce the uncertainty and modify the central value of PDF just on our data over here. And if luminosity is going, if the uncertainty on luminosity shrink with time, which is a machine issue, it's not our issue, we'll be able more precise and be able to tell even more than this. Now, you say, okay, this is good, you know how to handle an integral, do you know how to handle a distribution, a differential distribution. So we can measure the W and Z PT, and the W was an aggressive measurement, not made since run one at Tevatron, and we made it, and it is really precise because we reach 2 to 10% precision on the W PT measurement, depending on which bin you were. And what we see over here is that, first of all, resummation is important everywhere in PT, not just in low PT, but also in high PT. And we saw that, you know, next to link or alpha S squared, so next to next reader prediction, were not sufficient to make good prediction, even in the high PT. In the low PT, we knew, but in the high PT, we also saw that we couldn't really rely on those predictions and need to have proper modeling of the quark, the gluon emission, and parton shower and stuff like that, as we can see. So multiple parton emission is needed to model IPT, even for the vector boson PT, not just for jets. So the precision allows us to probe these kind of things and bring feedback to the standard model understanding of the standard model.
But maybe I'm misunderstanding your point, but here the lowest order, namely the red line, seems to be the most reasonable fit.
The red line, yes, it's the best thing, but this is ResBus. It's not ResBus is using resummation.
Ah.
Yeah. So what you do is that you have an NNLO,
right,
which is the green, and NLO of the same program, the same calculation, which is this one. So the next two next reading order are extremely important, but they are not yet there. So you need to have models of the of multiple emission, not just one or two emission. You need to have multiple emission for the vector boson PT. Is the resummation of the soft and collinear gluon emission. That is what you're doing. So. QCD technique. So basically, the LHC is a QCD machine. We are able to measure QCD really precisely comparing to theory and know what are the ingredients that we need to make physical prediction. And then, what if we adjust? If we are going more more exclusive final state, we essentially reach the same conclusion. We need to have an NLO calculation with parton shower in order to be able to make good predictions. You can see, for example, that the PTA, which is just one hard emission with parton shower, is doing a crappy job at getting our data right. And we can go clever and use ratios of measurement of cross sections plus W plus J over Z plus J, for example. And then we see over here that the theoretical uncertainty are smaller than what they are on the left hand plot. And they are at the comparison level of the systematic uncertainty in the measurement itself. So by exploiting proper measurement, we can cancel systematic uncertainty and reach precision. And this is exactly what we want to exploit over here. We want to exploit ratio to cancel a bunch of systematic uncertainties and use this to make prediction for new physics. Then we gain something. So yes, we rediscovered a standard model, which is important. But more importantly, we extend our knowledge of the standard models. And this is important for two things, because we want to break it, so we need to understand it really well. But also, we were in a new energy regime and a new QCD regime, so we needed to redo the understanding and develop further than what the theory tells us. So that gave us confidence now that I can use the standard models and try to go beyond it. So, okay, the simplest way to look for new physics is to look for deviation with standard models. And the way to do it is essentially count the number of events that you have of background, but also to count the number of events that you have from reducible background. So those for which they are not in your final state, they are not one jet plus missing ET, Well, they are 100 plus visibility, but not from the principle, but really from detector effect. So understanding your detector effect allows you to understand your residual background in rate, but also in shape, because they come from, you know, shape distortion, those detector effect, really. So why I'm saying this is because if you want to increase the sensitivity to your new phenomena, you can do two things. You can essentially increase the number of new physics you have, but this, I have no control on this. This is nature that gave it to me, unfortunately. Or you can improve your precision and your standard model expectations. And this is where I want to work. I want to show that we can, that the keys to control systematic uncertainty to increase sensitivity to new physics when the background is big. Typical Monte Carlo approach. So this is like a snapshot of an event. This is the collision, and then you know you have hadronization, and this is what you measure in your detectors. So you have uncertainties that come from the fact that you have jet and missing it energy scale and resolution, as well as lepton energy scale and resolution. As I mentioned before, that the jets calibration and stuff was bringing you big uncertainties. You need to suffer them when you come from simulation predictions. You have initial state, final state radiation, so you have QCD calculation effect, hadronization and fragmentation issue that are non-perturbative QCD effect that we don't understand really, really well. Underlying events is the same thing. We have the PDF that was mentioned before, pardon distribution function, that we don't understand really well. And we have some experimental conditions like trigger, pileup, luminosity, and in fact, the calculation itself. These are a bunch of systematic uncertainty that reduce the sensitivity to new physics. And I mentioned about the ratio measurement that don't suffer from any of those one, or really at the second order effect. So if we can use ratio like this to make predictions, then we improve a lot of sensitivity. So in general, how can you use data-driven estimate to reduce your uncertainties? Well, this is the pattern I just say. You have some processes. Maybe I should have made the arrow in the other direction. But so you have your simulation and your detector of some processes, and you get some distribution in blue. And then you have your data of the similar process that you select, and then you get your distribution in black. Now, what we want to do is say, I don't want a simulation anymore. I want to ditch this. So you do replace this by some data distribution that have different, similar feature of what you have difficulties to model. That's the same thing. And different feature of what you understand really well, leptons. And then you plot the distribution in blue, and you compare it with reduced uncertainties. So in practice, what you do is that you reverse some of the selections to avoid signal contamination. So suppose my analysis is this. This is all the event that we take. Then I apply a set of monojet cut. And these are my monojet event. Then you say, OK, I'm going to reverse one of the selection, keep the other one constant, and get another data region I'm going to use to model my signal region. And the point is that if your reverse selection are unbiased with the other selection that you apply in your signal, you will have that data model region will be a good model for your signal region. And the only thing which will be missing is essentially to count the number of events in the red zone and to normalize them. Okay. So now this is the principle. Let now use this into the monojet analysis, data-driven. So for the first place, the background, the dominant background is Z2 nu, so one jet, obviously. And you have WL nu, which you miss one of the lepton. Okay. So what we want to do here is to use Z2LL and WL nu plus jets event, where we do actually see the lepton to predict this background. Okay. So the cut to be reversed will be the lepton veto. Of course, when you do monojet analysis, you don't want to have lepton, so you apply a lepton veto. And this is the cut that you will reverse. Now, there is this other background, the QC background, for which we have multi-jets. And one of the jets is mismeasured and gives you monojet. So you want to essentially use event for which the missing ET point and desertion of the jet. So that tells you that you mismeasured that jet and reverse the number of jet cuts in order to make sure that you have a completely QCD-enriched samples to make your prediction. So for the electroweak background first, the idea is basically this. The jets in Z2E is the same as the Z in the jet in Z2 nu, right? So we can plot the distribution of that jet in Z2E. It's going to be the same shape as the one in Z2 nu. And the only thing you're going to have to do is to normalize the distribution properly. Now, how can you normalize it? Well, You need to apply correction factors from the fact that you have leptons. Well, the neutrino could be anywhere in your detectors, but your charged lepton has to be central. You need to detect them. You need to correct for the fact that you might fail identifying your leptons. So when I record, you have two electrons in the final state. There is some event that I'm ditching here. But this, I show with the inclusive measurement that I do understand it really well. I also show with the R-jet measurement, the ratio measurement, that I do understand this in function of jet PT. So I can probe kinematic region the way I want. And I know the systematics uncertainty, and I know they are small. Same thing, there is a background in UZ2ELL, which you need to account for, but this is the same business. We did it before in standard model measurement. We understand that. The branching ratio is different between Z2 nu nu and Z2L, but this we can take it from theory. It is, there is no systematic uncertainty cost in doing this.
Well, it's also been measured.
Huh?
It's also
been measured at the lep, in fact, yes. So the impact of taking this assumption is negligible. And then you have a small correction factors because the jet phase space is not the same thing when you have lepton and not when you have no lepton, because the lepton can radiate a gamma and the neutrino cannot radiate a gamma. So there is a small phase space correction that you need to apply. But basically, you put all those factors into that formula, and that gives you your normalization factors to be applied to the shape you get before.
But don't you also have to take into account when you measure the missing energy, you have some cuts on how close the missing energy can be to the jet.
Yeah.
And so you have to make sure that you apply the same sort of thing on the electrons.
And the electrons?
So how close the electrons are to the jet.
Yeah, so I skipped it just to be a bit simpler, but there is in fact two effects in there. So you have, so you're just over here, you have your electron over here, that guy can irradiate, but also you need to remove it from your calorimeter. So you need to, you remove bits of the energy that might belong to some other small jets that are close by, which affect the phase space differently than if you had a neutrino in there rather than an electron. So there's those two effects, that's right, yes, that you need to cut. They are the level of 5 to 10%, they're not big, which is good because this usually you use Monte Carlo to estimate this, and you say I have like a 20% uncertainty in this 5% effect, it's fine. It's a 1% uncertainty overall. Right? Then you have the W background, and you have to do the same business as what I just mentioned, but rather than having the space factors, you need to compute the probability of missing the lepton. This you need it from Monte Carlo, but you have jet costs at both numerators and denominators, so they essentially cancel in the ratio, and you're left with understanding something which is just like geometrical acceptance, which is reasonably well understood, most loose on PDF issues. Then what I wanted to say over here is that you can increase the statistical significance of your measurement by using W to make prediction on Z to nu nu, because you basically just need to scale your predictions with another factor, which is the trickle ratio. And that trickle ratio is really well behaved, because there is no PDF uncertainty and small scale uncertainties. So then, all for all, you can get really high precision predictions for four statistically independent measurement that you can combine and essentially improve your predictions. So I'll give you the result in a minute. I just want to show you what happened with QCD. So in QCD, as I said, you basically, most of the time, have one jet recording another one, but that jet over here, you can't measure it because you lose it somehow, right? So how you can estimate that background from data? Well, what you do is that you say, okay, these are events for which the second jet point in the direction of the missing ET, right? And at that point over here, up to there, I'm losing that jet, right? So it becomes my background. My two jets event become a one jet event in that region over here. So if you do just a simple extrapolation of that distribution and compute the area under the curve, you will have your background prediction for QCD. And usually what you want to do is to choose selections that this background will be really small, but nevertheless, it's extremely important to show that you have it under control. So now let's see some results and see some event. So here we have a really nice monojet event, one jet, and therefore nothing to recall against it. But when you look at the other vision of it, you kind of see a nasty track over here that point to the jets and don't point to the center of the detector. And you see it again on that view over here. Well, that is a good sign of a cosmic ray. And cosmic ray, so monojet event prompt for a non-collision background, because they are so simple signatures, that, you know, crappy things from outside can sneak in. So we have to be extremely careful to kill this as much as we can, because it's extremely difficult to predict how much they affect you. You can use timing of calibrators.
Now that you've seen those events, can you use the number of events you've seen to predict how many times you'll, this would actually be a background where you cannot resolve how far away from the...
Not that you, so there is two things there. So the one thing is that we have this long, these long cosmic runs before the startup of the collisions. So we could use this to make some estimate. In fact, we use this to tailor the cut, and we kill them all. After the full long period of the cosmic collision we had, we sum all the data, we apply a cut, and there were left no zero event. Problem is now when you have min bias event, when you have pileup or whatever, you might have overlay of those two events, like a cosmic ray and actual really soft QCD effect, for which you will have like many of your cuts will survive because you will have a track pointing to your calibrator clusters and so on and so forth. So the background will not be zero, and it's, you cannot estimate it really independently. If you do same thing, some people are thinking about using empty bunches to measure this background, but as the same business, you don't have those min bias that enhance this background. So what you do is you want to make sure that you cut it as much as possible. You use simulation to show what happened when you have those min bias to show that they are under control. And then you can use some things like calibrator timing to essentially, you know, control it to see, okay, they are the percent of, you know, 1% level or below 1% or something like that. And basically, this is how you can do it. But this is a really nice monojet event. Then you see like many tracks making your jets. You're missing ET. That was the most energetic event that we get at CDF with 420 GV of jets and missing ET. In Atlas, not the most energetic one, just one event was blowing up this limit. So the LHA is extremely powerful because it probed a kinematic region that we're not really able to probe before. So if I come back to the CDF result, that's what I wanted to say. You see, the overall prediction for the background is, you know, almost 9,000 events. This is a huge background. But the precision on this is extremely big. The precision is extremely nice. It is less than 4% precision on that big QCD background. This is a proof that these methods work extremely well. Of course, the other thing that you spot from that plot is that these two numbers agree well within the errors, which tell you have no new physics in this. But at least, we have been able to put tighter constraint on a scenario for which you have big background with, you know, lack of understanding on many, many aspects, and yet be clever enough to make precision out of it.
What's the
cause? So just because I was talking about model independence before, right? So rather than choosing one kinematic region to do the measurement, I choose three different kinematic regions to do the measurement, such that if you come with your models and you prefer to have this region, you can take it for your limit. And if your model prefers this one, you can take it for your limit.
So what do you need to observe to exclude extrapolation? A number.
Yeah, so this is the number of observed events that you have, right? In order to, so from that, we get the limits of how many?
What's the 3-4 sigma?
Right, so what we did is to get a 95% confidence. I remember that. For that column, it was 125 event or below to exclude the anything, right? I can't remember from this one. Because what I did then is that I didn't use this number, I used that number to choose a priori which was the best region to look for LED. It turned out to be this one. Then I set up that regardless of the new physics idea that you had in mind, you needed to have less than 125 new physics event at 95% confidence level in order to satisfy the observation. And that 125 event is the golden number that you want to use to set your limits. But you need another things. You don't need also the acceptance of a detector for your models. This is why also we put the acceptance of the LED into that picture.
So when you go to find the inverse spectrum box, which they now have, how would that more luminosity more is what do you expect to get from?
Right. So there is two things. So when you do the data-driven estimate of the background, right, you need to have event in there. So you have a statistical limitation. And that region add the statistical limitation. But then when you have a lot of event, like you had in that region, then you are no more statistically limited, you're systematically again limited, right? So I'm expecting to have, if with more event, I'm expecting to have the same type of 4% precision on that number over here, which is, now it is above 4%, but it's because of the statistical limitation. And that 4%, you cannot really kill it. In fact, when I use R, the theoretical uncertainties was 3.1%, if I remember well. So this, I take it as the strong limitation on the measurement that I can reach, and that tells us that I can increase this in that region. I could increase by 20, a factor of 20, the luminosity will not change the precision on that measurement.
How do you exclude or verify extrapolation?
Verify?
At what point do you exclude or verify extra dimensions, say by 4 or 5 seconds?
Well, you already do it at some level for some gravity scale.
You can. Yeah, and also.
I mean, this is what you're trying to do.
No, but yeah, I would recast the question a bit differently. I will say, what will be your cross section limits for a 5 sigma exclusion? What will be your cross section limit for a 2 sigma exclusion? You see what I mean? And you will have one for which the exclusion cross section will be high, but you have, you know, like 99.999% of the chance of losing. The other one, the cross section will be a bit lower for your exclusion, but you will have a smaller confidence level into it, right? So I will recast the question that way. So I could have, so basically it's just a question of statistics, right? I can choose 2 sigma, I can choose 1 sigma, I could choose 5 sigma, and the impact will be just to shift the limits upward and downward, right? So
I think his question is a little simpler than what
I think he's just asking, are you going to quote a bound on that gravity scale?
Right.
Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah. So, sorry. I thought we were talking about the principle behind it. Yeah, these are the limits that we quote on MD, or if you convert it to the radius of extra dimension, this is the limit that CDF was able to quote. Okay, they were the best limits in n equal 4 and above, but we were not able to beat let in a way in the lower region. And the reason essentially why the slope is different between our limit and their limit is essentially the point that you were bringing, is the contribution of the different processes. They are essentially QQ bar, completely just QQ bar, if you want, but it's E plus E minus. While we have QG and glu and the spectrum, the contribution, the dominance of each changes. And at some point, because we had like QG and glu that start to kick in, for which lab they didn't add, they just decay like this, but we were able to, you know, redress the slope a little bit. And now this is Atlas. These are the best limits of the world that kick CDF hard time. And these were made with 1 inverse femtobound, but really, 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 really fast. Not exploiting the full business of what I just presented before, but just using half of it, really, just like the normalization that I was presenting. So so with 5 inverse femtobound, and so the idea is essentially that I don't care so much if the limit is 3.2 or 3.5 or 2.8. What I do care is that we have, in end, the best way to probe it, and then when it's going to be 14 TeV, we will right away put the best scenario right away, because with these limits, if we have fun in excess, we will not be able to explain it because the systematics were not well handled and something like that. But with what I showed before, you do understand things really, really well. So if you see an excess, you also believe it, right? So this is why I think that we should put effort in addition of reaching with higher limits or more sensitivity. You give confidence on the discovery if you find it. I forgot to tell you this. 2 seconds and then I conclude. With such precision, you can recast again monojet event to do a standard model measurement. You can measure the invisible width of the Z or the number of neutrino family, for example, because you have high precision. Of course, this has been measured at LEP, but it has been measured in 2 ways. Indirectly from line shape, which is still an indirect measurement, but they did the direct measurement with gamma plus MET, which is less precise. And we can target the precision of gamma plus MET measurement at LEP. And this is really interesting because it is, we can get similar sensitivity to LEP direct result in hadronic collider, which is astonishing. Fewer theoretical uncertainty because there is a lot of theoretical uncertainty on that measurement, they fit to the A plus E minus collision cross section and so on and so forth, which we don't need as you saw, and it is completely independent of flip result. So we tried it, and we reached that result, and that's a bit unfortunate because this is more like 8 to 9% uncertainties rather than the 3.8% that I was quoting before. And the point of this is that the W background is important compared to the Z to new contribution at the T-Veteran. And that was giving a bigger weight to the uncertainties, inflating it. But at but the LHC, because we have a super hermetic detector, that's not true anymore. And the Z to new dominate by a factor of 2 over the W. So if we can reach the same 4% precision on the prediction of the W background at the LHC, we will reach a precision of 1 to 2%. We will even beat L3 in the precision of that measurement.
What do you mean by the measured width of gamma Z is 2.48?
That is the overall width. Overall width.
There is about
5%. The error on the total width? No, it is 0.02%. It is extremely precise. It is really, really precise. But what they do is that they measured also Z in QQ bar, Z in E plus E minus, Z in tau tau, Z in mu mu. They take all this, they subtract it from that measurement we're talking about, and they say, okay, this is Z inf. So that is this result over here, which is not anymore at 0.02%. But then this is assuming everything that you don't see is your Z to neutrino, for example. If you don't make that assumption, you're obliged to measure it directly. And then you go to those results over here, and then they are less precise. And the one thing I want to say over here, finally, is that now that we can do a precision or precise measurement of some standard model quantity, you can recast the full monojet analysis as a measurement of that. Then you compare to actual result from LEP, from this one, or actual standard model predictions, and then you can see for deviation. So you have both robust ends, the predictions and the measurement. And so as a conclusion, so the LHC work well. We haven't found anything yet, but we have tools in hand to be able to do it. Thank you.
I understood your last slide. So the thing you're saying about the connection between the monojets and this was what?
So in order to measure this, you need so these are monojets.
Yeah.
So you use monojets to measure them.
Yeah.
So what you do? So what you want to do is that you make a prediction for the background to Z to nu nu. So monojets contain Z to nu nu event plus some background. Yeah. You make your prediction for this background. You extract from it a measurement of that bits over here, and then you compare it, and then you have. If you are precise on your background prediction and you are precise in your standard model quantity prediction, then you just one sensitivity.
And you're expecting to be comparable in accuracy to these things.
I believe, well, still need to be done. I have a student working on that. But I believe that if we reach a 5% predictions on the background, which is a bit lower than what we did over here, so being conservative a bit, because the detector is hermetic, the W background compared to the Z to nu nu contribution to monojet is smaller, and therefore this 5% will end up to be at 2.5%, 3%, and will be able to beat or to compete with L3. Yes?
Why is it that both Atlas, CMS, and Temperatron have not seen any new physics? Because they
does he look like the oracle from Delphi?
I've seen the quark, quarks, electrons, happy Z, gluon, photon, bad part. Precisely to what you said. So isn't it striking that nothing's been seen up to TDD?
Yeah, this is what I was mentioning in my introduction. It is striking, but all those measurements are made in a corner phase space. And we don't know what is in the other phase space region, so this is where her hopes lay. You know? So it's a question of scales, and so we need to dig out over there.
This continues.
Huh? It will continue until we find something.
Then we're fucked. Yeah. So
if
you take your limit for on the gravity scale,
yeah,
and you take you have 10 femtoparticle amounts of, so you take the 2012 data set and you don't change the energy, you know, how much does that change? How far do you hope you would get?
I can't tell much because for that measurement, I haven't checked all the background prediction that they made. And they use a lot of Monte Carlo, as I say. So if we use the technique that I just showed, I don't know, I don't have any idea of where it's going to be there. So it's hard for me to tell.
So you don't think it will just increase with the square root of the luminosity?
No. It's true if you're completely statistically dominated, but we're not necessarily statistically dominated. The point is that, so the short story...
Why are you not statistically dominated?
Huh?
Why are you not?
It depends on the chemistry region for which you set your limit on.
No, so let's suppose we just look at the same thing, right? Same plot, but with 5 inputs of the plot.
Yeah.
You want to just scale this per.
So as I say,
that means that the
you need to pick up a region to do your prediction, right?
Yeah.
Suppose they use this one.
Right.
Suppose they use a region like this for which the statistics is plenty. If you multiply by 2, 3, 5, 10 the statistics, you will still be systematically limited. If they use this region for which they are systematically limited, if they multiply by 10, of course they will have a factor of 3 increase in the sensitivity. So it depends a lot of where you put yourself to set your limit in. The other thing is that this limit has to be taken with a pinch of salt. Because of the LHC, they use a calculation for which the calculation becomes non-unitary in the phase space, in the part of the phase space that we probe over here, right? So I was complaining a lot to my colleague to not take to high kinematic region and to concentrate themselves in something like this in order to less be sensitive to those things and allow you guys to be able to have a feeling of what is going on if you increase luminosity. But perfectly bad example, so.
When you go to 14 TeV in 2014 and say a luminosity, 80 degree luminosity of 100 microseconds,
13.
What's going to happen?
13. The guess that we had was 13 TeV for n equal 2. Yeah. But
so you go up?
It goes up by quite a lot because the cross sections are blowing up.
But it's the energy that counts. So that's what I'm trying to get. So if it's a factor of 3, you would have got from the square root of n. If it had been the square root of n, you would have been in the cross section. But then the cross section is only 1 over the mass, the fourth power or something. So the mass isn't actually going up very much, even if the cross section is there.
No, yes. Yeah.
But it's the energy rising.
Yeah, the energy rises the cross section and therefore rise your limit, and the statistics rise your sensitivity essentially. So your statistical test basically. So the 125 number of event that I was mentioning to you, if you cut the statistic by a factor of 2, that number of 125 might go down to 70, I don't know, 80 or whatever. And that affects your limits as well. So the two factors are important. But it's true that for free, because you have higher cross-section, just with the same luminosity that we have, if you double the center of mass energy, then boom, you put your limits much higher. And you trust better your calculation as well. So it's a win-win situation.
So we have the speaker for the rest of the day today, so if there's any more questions, we can do it later, but I think I want to just